Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Justin Glau, an independent journalist who writes the American Doom newsletter, examines the Trump-Musk attack on Social Security that could shatter the program that serves the nation's most vulnerable. Lisa Gilbert, co-president of Public Citizen, who talks about her group's 8 lawsuits challenging the Trump regime's wave of unconstitutional and lawless actions. And journalist Sam Carliner, who discusses the Trump administration's detention of Palestinian student Mahmoud Khalil and others as student activists nationwide fight increasing government repression. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Former Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte was arrested at the Manila airport on March 11th and flown to The Hague on an arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court. Duterte will face charges of crimes against humanity relating to his brutal war on drugs, where an estimated 30,000 people were killed. Duterte's arrest is a major victory for human rights defenders. Current Philippines President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. ran with Duterte's daughter Sarah as his vice presidential running mate in 2022 and won in a landslide, promising to continue the elder Duterte's policies. Although Marcos had repeatedly declined to cooperate with the ICC, he changed his mind this week, allowing the arrest of his predecessor to proceed. Many observers believe that Marcos permitted the arrest to go forward after Duterte's supporters called for his resignation, and his vice president, Sara Duterte, was impeached on allegations of misuse of millions of dollars in government funds. In an interview with Al Jazeera, Maria Cristina Conti, an attorney who represents some of the families of Duterte's victims, said it was crucial for Filipinos to witness the resolution and prosecution of the case so that it will not happen again. In the days before the March 11th White House crypto summit, attended by top cryptocurrency executives and investors, Donald Trump's U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission had dropped a series of cases against major crypto companies, including Coinbase, Gemini, OpenSea, and Uniswap Labs. The SEC also announced it had little interest in regulating meme coins, not long after Trump had rolled out his own meme coin before his January 20th inauguration. Ethics watchdogs are alarmed at Trump's rapid reversal of the Biden administration's 4-year drive to classify nearly all digital coins as securities, subject to the same strict rules that govern stocks and bonds traded on Wall Street. According to The Intercept, executives attending the White House crypto summit had given over $11 million to Trump's inaugural committee and donated much more to his 2024 campaign. Delaney Marsco of the Campaign Legal Center, a nonprofit watchdog group, said, "When you put the Trump administration's near total deregulation of the crypto industry in the context of the campaign and inaugural fund donations, it paints a really troubling picture of potential corruption." During his mid-January confirmation hearing, Doug Collins, Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of Veterans Affairs, heard complaints from a bipartisan group of U.S. senators about $31 billion spent to outsource veterans' health care services to private for-profit vendors and major cost overruns of a contract to overhaul the VA's electronic medical record keeping, both of which occurred during Trump's first term. But under Secretary Collins, plans are moving forward to fire some 83,000 VA staff by August in order to meet Trump's executive order to downsize the federal government. Representative Mark Takano, Democrat of California, warned that the massive layoff will create chaos across every aspect of the VA, delaying benefits and straining claims processing. Connecticut's Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal believes the Trump administration's ultimate goal is to starve the VA's capacity to meet increased demand in order to justify privatizing all Veterans Administration operations. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Over its 90-year history, Social Security has been one of the U.S. government's most popular and widely supported programs. After President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law in 1935, and checks started being issued to recipients over 80 years ago, the program has had an exemplary record of never missing a payment. But that may be about to change. After President Trump launched his campaign to eliminate or make massive cuts to federal agencies, led by his top campaign contributor, billionaire Elon Musk, the Social Security Administration announced plans to reduce its staff by 7,000 employees. The program has also said it will close 6 of its 10 regional offices and more than 40 of its 1,200 field offices, where the public goes to make claims and seek assistance. Martin O'Malley, the former Social Security Commissioner under President Joe Biden, warns that the dramatic cuts in staffing and office closures could trigger a total system collapse that would disrupt basic customer service and timely payment of benefits to some 73 million elderly, disabled, and infirmed recipients. Your reporter spoke with Justin Glau, an independent journalist who writes the American Doom newsletter. Here he discusses his latest Rolling Stone magazine investigation into the Trump administration's actions that could shatter the once reliable Social Security system.
In talking with O'Malley, who was Social Security Commissioner under Biden for a year, you know, basically what he has said is, look, the Social Security Administration was already understaffed at a time when there are more and more people signing up for benefits as baby boomers retire. And, you know, this isn't just a government agency head saying, oh, we need more people, we need more people. There have been independent government studies that show that the level of staffing at SSA has gone down as the number of beneficiaries have gone up. So, you know, his point is pretty simple. If they're already understaffed, cutting more staff is not going to help out the agency do what it needs to do in terms of getting benefits to people and helping people sign up for benefits.
It's been talked about that 7,000 Social Security Administration workers may be laid off, fired, or terminated. That's a large percentage of the workforce.
Yeah, it's about 12% of the workforce, and I can't think off the top of my head if they've said exactly who those people are going to be. But, you know, what they've been doing is they've been eliminating offices at the headquarters. They've been closing field offices. DOGE has slated, I think, 47 field offices in 24 states to be closed. So as your listeners, some of them I'm sure are aware, these are the places that you go to sometimes apply for benefits and to, you know, turn in paperwork and things like that. And DOGE is looking to eliminate those offices entirely. So they just won't exist. So you'll have to call an 800 number or drive to the office, you know, the next county over or something like that. Again, this all looks to be in O'Malley and Democrats' estimations, really just an attempt probably to sort of break Social Security and then look and say, oh, look, you know, it's broken. You know, we have to replace it. Look at this very, very broken agency. You know, let's privatize some services or, you know, whatever the end goal is. And O'Malley and others think that that's probably what's going on.
One other episode in terms of recent outrage targeted at what DOGE, Musk, and Trump are doing was there was a proposal, I believe, to shut down the phone systems of Social Security. There was some really strong backlash because many seniors, of course, don't know much about the internet, can't rely on the internet to get specific information for their policies and benefits. So what happened there? Update us on that threat to shut down the phone system so real people could answer the phone and help you with your benefit questions.
Well, yeah, they backtracked on it. But what I think has been a little bit missed in some of the coverage of that is that, you know, well before they said that they were thinking about doing away with the phone system, what drew me into reporting on this however many weeks ago it was, is that they already have canceled, eliminated offices and employees who deal with online customer service stuff. So the person who I was initially talking to about this worked on customer service issues for people trying to navigate the system online. And so even though they backtracked on the phone thing, they have eliminated people to help online and they're eliminating the field offices. So still kind of looks like just cutting down on the amount of help that people can get.
Justin, what are the possible repercussions for these major cuts to staffing at the Social Security Administration? There's some 73 million Social Security recipients around the country, many of them seniors, many totally reliant on their Social Security checks to make it from one month to the next. If checks are delayed, or God knows what, if there's no staff to deal with the needed bureaucracy to process checks and the like, what are the possible consequences here?
Well, I mean, everything that you can imagine when you are living on a fixed income and you don't have your source of income. You know, people won't be able to pay their rent. They'll miss mortgage payments. They might not be able to purchase medication. So they'll have potential health problems as a result of this. And, you know, O'Malley and others are quick to point out that Social Security has really been a huge success in its time. Like they never miss a payment. In fact, if anything, they're guilty of overpaying people, which was the subject of the story that came out this morning of mine at Rolling Stone. So the repercussions of this are grave, I think, if it ends up being a situation where because of the reduced staffing and the reduced workforce, that payments stop going out to some people. You know, that's going to be really devastating for a lot of people. And it's not just, you know, seniors and retired folks. It is disabled folks who can't work. It's disabled children. It's the children of disabled folks who can't work, who receive these benefits. And, you know, it's everything from, like I said, paying rent and mortgage and buying medicine to, you know, just putting food on the table.
That was Justin Glau, an independent journalist who writes the American Doom newsletter. His forthcoming book is titled, If I'm Coming to Your Town, Something Terrible Has Happened. Find a link to his recent investigations on Social Security by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Soon after Donald Trump took office on January 20th, Public Citizen, the nonprofit consumer advocacy group, sued the administration over the questionable conduct of the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, led by billionaire Elon Musk. Over the past 8 weeks, Musk, along with a team of young computer coders, have attempted to dismantle or eliminate dozens of federal agencies and offices and fire hundreds of thousands of government workers. In late January, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Public Citizen's co-president, Lisa Gilbert, about the original lawsuit filed against DOGE, and talked with her again this week, where she described seven additional lawsuits her group has filed against the Trump administration. The issues identified in these new lawsuits include an attempt to stop violations of the Privacy Act at the Department of Education, where sensitive student loan information may have been breached by DOGE, an effort to reverse Trump's dismantling of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and a demand to release frozen USAID funds to restart life-saving humanitarian aid programs. Here, Gilbert talks about the lawsuits, responding to the Trump regime's lawlessness, and addresses the question of whether or not the U.S. is now in the midst of a constitutional crisis.
Since then, we've actually filed seven additional suits. So we've been deep in the mix on a host of issues ranging from Privacy Act violations where DOGE is attempting to get our personal information from the Treasury Department database or from the Department of Education, all of our student loan records, and on and on. We've sued to try to restart Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, deal with the fact that foreign aid, humanitarian aid has been ceased from USAID, and really on and on. It's been just a onslaught of lawlessness from the administration, and so we've been pushing back in every way we can.
So when you said DOGE is trying to get people's, you know, private information, don't they already have it?
In places where we've been able to stop them, no. That is what they want to do. You know, they wanted to infiltrate the system at the U.S. Treasury Department, which, you know, holds our Social Security information and Medicare payment information and taxpayer refund information and on and on. But we won a temporary restraining order. So that put a halt to direct access for most folks that are associated with DOGE. And it's now proceeding through the courts. Well, you know, we wait to see if we can win the full case. So not yet is the answer. And we're very hopeful.
People seem to be really unwilling to say we are in right now a constitutional crisis because Musk and Trump et al., they're defying court rulings. There was just the latest one was a judge told them to bring the planes back from sending Venezuelans to El Salvador to be imprisoned there. And they sort of thumbed their nose and sort of laughed about it on social media. And they did not obey. In terms of the purview of Congress, they're just cutting things right and left that were already approved by Congress and money should have gone through. And they're doing that. So are we in a constitutional crisis or not?
It's a great question. I think we are certainly seeing a slip into that type of state of being. But I would say that there will be a moment, I believe, where we are, where they clearly, you know, defy in a blatant manner, where there is no excuse, where they cannot say the court order was issued, you know, verbally when we were already in the air. They, you know, there will be no excuses. And it will be as blatant and clear as day. I think, you know, there will be a moment when it is obvious that there and nothing else to say. I think in this moment, we're seeing a lot of lawless abuses, but I hesitate to say that this is as bad as it's going to get or that this is the full-throated crisis, if you will, but it's certainly not good. And I think we still have a chance to win many of these cases. We still have a chance to fight back, but we are not going in the right direction in terms of the administration's seriousness and what they're attempting to do. I mean, I think staying the course on a significant number of these cases is incredibly important because we are moving in the right direction. You know, take the DOGE invasion of the Department of Education. You know, the case is proceeding. We are working to block DOGE's access to the financial information of thousands of student loan applicants and their families. You know, it is not over yet. And I think that is the case for a lot of these cases. The court system isn't always fast. And I agree that it is not smart to say that any one remedy will save us. But that said, you know, we are winning in many places. I'm sure you've seen the probationary employees that were fired are now being recalled. You know, there are chances to win and we should keep fighting.
You're in that world. What do you see as the role of, you know, people who aren't representing cases in court, like just mass movements? What do you think there's a role for them?
I think there's a huge role for them. I think that litigation is a piece of the puzzle, but in no way the whole puzzle. You know, it is important for people to mobilize and engage. You know, we are getting to critical junctures where that makes a huge difference. We're in a recess week right now, where we should be drawing attention to what just happened in Congress last week. You know, we should be calling out the administration and DOGE for everything that they're doing. There's a huge day of action on April 5th to do just that. And I think helping to turn the public narrative and the press coverage to deeper understanding of what the administration is doing is a role that regular Americans have a huge part in.
That was Lisa Gilbert, co-president of Public Citizen. Learn more about Public Citizens and other lawsuits challenging the Trump administration's wave of unconstitutional actions by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On March 8th,
the Trump administration detained Mahmoud Khalil, a Palestinian Columbia University student and permanent U.S. resident, with the intention of deporting him because of his lawful participation in Gaza war protests on campus last spring. Although Khalil was never charged with a crime, Trump Secretary of State Marco Rubio authorized the deportation order on the dubious grounds that the graduate student posed serious adverse foreign policy consequences. A federal judge has since blocked the deportation of Khalil, whose lawyers maintain was politically motivated and unlawful. Ranjani Srinivasan, an international Columbia student from India, fled to Canada after learning that her student visa had been revoked by the Department of Homeland Security, that charged without any evidence that she had been involved in activities supporting Hamas, a terrorist organization. On March 17th, Rasha Alawiya, a doctor and Brown University professor from Lebanon, was deported despite having a U.S. visa due to what Homeland Security officials said was her support for a Hezbollah leader and attending his funeral. What these cases all have in common is the Trump regime's revocation of visas and green card status from people engaged in protected political speech and then being deprived of any due process to challenge allegations made against them. Trump has also deported more than 200 alleged Venezuelan gang members to El Salvador under the Alien Enemies Act, denying the deportees their due process rights in defiance of a judge's order. Your reporter spoke with journalist Sam Carliner, who discusses Mahmoud Khalil's detention and other punitive actions taken against university students and professors, and its impact on student activists nationwide, who are fighting increasing U.S. government repression.
Despite, you know, having every intention, this administration has to deport him. They have not been able to. I think, in large part, the widespread scrutiny that this move has faced, as well as protests in opposition, of course, as well as the legal action that's been taken to block his deportation, are significant. But it seems like they're trying to pull from a Cold War era law that gives the Secretary of State more authority to essentially go against standard immigration policy and procedures to just deem certain people as threats to national security and deport them that way. It seems pretty clear that this case has received a lot of attention and I think has really shown people the way in which these escalating attacks on immigrants, as well as the escalating repression of people's right to protest. And I think it has to be noted that anti-war protests in particular, I think throughout U.S. history, have been some of the first targets of attempts to strengthen executive power, right? It seems like this case has shown to a lot of people how intertwined these issues are. And I think the backlash to this move has in large part slowed the administration's ability to deport Mahmoud Khalil, but we'll see how it plays out.
I think it's widely believed that this is a test case, as you indicated, Sam, because if they can get away with this through the courts or just by blustering their way around the courts in the U.S. Constitution, they are going to target many more people, non-citizens, as well as citizens, possibly. We don't know where this is headed, but mm-hmm. this is an important case because they are testing the waters to see how much they can get away with. What are your feelings about that and concern of where this may go next?
I think that's absolutely true. It is a test case, and I'm glad you mentioned that. Before the news, right, of Mahmoud Khalid's detention came about, I had already started writing this article to focus on two other examples of attacks on the movement, cases that I think are also very important, which is that in the University of Michigan and the City University of New York, two public universities, you still have protesters from the wave of encampments that we saw last spring. At both of these schools, protesters who were involved in encampments on those campuses are facing felony charges for their peaceful activism, and they've been trying to figure out how to get the charges dropped. And I'm sure there's other cases, right, that I haven't reported on necessarily, but I think to me, in a way, the basis that we were already seeing of charges of these activists has set the framework for now another even more extreme test in terms of the detention and potential deportation of Mahmoud Khalid, as well as the other activists that we are now seeing being detained and deported.
Sam, in talking about this ramped up effort by the Trump regime to deport students who have been active in the anti-Israel Gaza war encampments last spring on campus, as well as some of the felony charges lodged against peaceful protesters, this is obviously designed to intimidate and chill free speech on campus when it comes to the issue of Israel-Palestine. I can imagine a lot of foreign students would be reluctant to be out there on the campus grounds protesting at this point for fear they may have their student visa revoked. And there may be a lot of other U.S. native-born citizens who may themselves be reluctant to involve themselves in protests for concern they may be expelled or otherwise punished by the universities, which have shown no reluctance to unfairly, in my view, try to mete out punishment for peaceful protest.
Even if the deportations don't carry forward or if the felony charges, if people aren't found guilty of those, even just the process of having to legally defend yourself against these charges, it bogs down the movement in a lot of ways. I'm an optimist, and I believe with what I am seeing, it is possible that the way in which this attack is so egregious, it might be an opportunity for the movement to maybe draw in support from some people who maybe until now didn't see the stakes and the importance of defending the right to protest Israel's attacks on Gaza. I've been seeing some immigrant rights organizations speak a lot more candidly, right, about the attack on pro-Palestine protesters and how that's a problem. So maybe that can build a bridge and bring in new sectors, but I think it also means a lot of people who have been organizing now have extra risks they have to consider.
That was journalist Sam Carliner, an editor at Left Voice. Find a link to his recent article titled "How Pro-Palestine Student Activists Are Fighting Increasing Repression" by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WOOL in Bellows Falls, Vermont, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KYRS in Spokane, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.